Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. In case you haven't heard, there's a little bit of a leadership race going on. Apparently, even the envy of the little Alberta party off to the side. We saw them trying to get in there a little bit too, just a couple days ago. But we've been having some conversations with leadership candidates for the NDP leadership race. Rachel Notley has announced her intention to step down after the leadership race is done. I think I got that right. If not, I'm about to be corrected. But we've been working our way through conversations with some of the candidates, and we are very excited to continue that process tonight. So we're very well excited to welcome to the show Racki Pancholi.
Hi, Nate. Great to see you on the show. I've been watching, but this is the first time you and I have actually got a chance to talk directly to each other. So this
Right,
is
and
cool. Thank
I
you.
even had my little fanboy moment earlier in the pre-interview where I was giving you props for your conversation and outing the costs of the Tylenol, so we wouldn't have to do that here. But I still found managed to find a way to do it. What are you gonna do?
Just goes to show opposition can sometimes be incredibly valuable, right?
That's actually a very valid point because I spent a lot of time making jokes at the expense of opposition. So
I won't take it personally, Nate.
I take that correction. Before we get into the whole conversation around the NDP leadership race, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about who you are and what brought you into the realm of not just politics, but in particular New Democrat politics, because that's a whole different thing in and of itself. Many people say, I don't know. I'll ask for your thoughts on it. Who is Racki, and how'd you get into politics?
Well, thanks for the question. I'd like to say I'm a proud Albertan, a proud Edmontonian. My story is very similar to thousands of people in this province. My parents immigrated to Canada in the late 60s, chose Alberta because this is a place that many people continue to think of as a great place of opportunity. Landed here, I was, grew up in southwest Edmonton, an area that I'm now very proud to represent as the MLA for Edmonton White Mud, now in my second term. But I wasn't actually did not have a path or a plan to get into politics. Although on paper, I always joke, Nate, that my story seems like the typical politician. I grew up here in Edmonton. I went and I did a poli sci degree over at University of Alberta, then went on to law school at University of Toronto, came back. I did a little stint practicing and studying in South Africa for a little bit. Came back to Alberta, to Edmonton, which was home, started working and practicing law here, did that for 13 years, and then got asked and approached, and I should mention, by one of my fellow colleagues and fellow candidates in this Alberta NDP leadership race. It was Sarah Hoffman who actually approached me in late 2018 and asked me if I would be interested in running for the Alberta NDP in the upcoming election. So one of the things I talk about quite a bit, because I think it's a big part of who I am and why I'm running, is that I actually wasn't a partisan person before I ran. When Rachel was premier, I had just had my second child. I'm a parent of two kids. I was practicing law. I watched Rachel as premier, thought she was incredibly pragmatic and thoughtful, excited to see a progressive woman leading in politics in this province, something I never thought I'd see. But then, when I got approached to run, it was really a chance for me to talk about the things that I'm passionate about in this province, things like education, things like healthcare, things like a strong economy. Those were things I always cared about in a nonpartisan way, just wanted the best for this province. And so when I was approached to run, I really thought this was a chance to take that advocacy to the next level. Instead of sitting around the dinner table and arguing with my father-in-law about politics, I got to, step forward and use my voice. I certainly didn't see a lot of people, particularly women of color in politics, watching as I had for many years. And it seemed like an opportunity to step forward, use my voice, and also be a role model to my kids. Public service is deeply important to who I am. It's always been something I've done and been part of, and I want my kids to see how important it is to contribute in whatever way. It doesn't have to be politics. In fact, I think lots of people contribute in very profound ways that have nothing to do with politics. But there is something about public service and working to make your community and your city and your province a better place. And I felt like this was my chance to participate in that. So that's why I threw my hat in the ring in the 2019 election and was elected for the first time at that point.
Now I got a question about that 2019 election, but before we get to that, I got to ask, what kind of law Were you practicing for all of those years?
Yeah, so for 13 years, so the first 8 years is actually within the government of Alberta with Alberta Education. So it's kind of where my heart is in education. That's something I did for many years. So I was advising various ministers of education, all PCs, because I actually, my entire time in government was before the Alberta NDP became government. Worked for many ministers, helped draft legislation. The Education Act is one of the pieces of work that I did for many years under three different education ministers. And then I focused on labor and employment and went into private practice working for school boards. And so mostly labor and employment, but also privacy law, governance issues, statutory interpretation, human rights pieces, but all for school boards. So that's what I did right up until the point that I got asked to be involved in politics.
Now, one of the things that people have highlighted is we've had Kathleen Ganley on the show, we've had Sarah Hoffman on the show, and one of the big differences that has existed in the pundit class, if you will, is because you were elected in 2019, you kind of came after the 4 years of the NDP as government, and some people have said that that gives you some distance, if you will, from the NDP government of 2015 to 2019. And I'm curious what your thoughts on are on that sort of commentary. Is that distance something that you acknowledge? Is it something that you want? Is it something that you don't want? Is it just silly pundits being silly pundits? What do you think?
Well, I'd like to keep silly pundits busy. That's a really important job. But I will say, I just mentioned I ran because I watched Rachel Notley's premier and watched the government of the time. Was it a perfect government? Of course not. No government is, and it was only 4 years, and it wasn't a lot of time to get done the ambitious things that I think the Alberta NDP and many Albertans wanted to get done. But I was inspired by the work that my colleagues who are also running, who served as ministers, the work they did. They achieved some incredible things that made me want to be part of that team. So that was certainly part of it. But I also will say, having being elected for the first time as an opposition member after government, it did give me an insight to sort of have conversations with people in various different sectors across the province to sort of get a picture of what could the Alberta NDP do a little bit differently. And one of the things that I think, I hope the strength that I bring as a leadership candidate now is that I am very open to trying to grow our party. I want to talk to more people. I don't feel very invested in trying to test out who is a true Alberta NDP and who's not. I got to hear from lots of folks who said, you know, they wish they had a more open relationship with members of the NDP government. And that was a lesson that I took sort of very to heart, because my instinct is to meet with as many people as possible to get a really broad perspective on issues. The constituency I represent in Southwest Edmonton, the folks there, you know, for historically have been PC for a very long time. They don't really care deeply about partisan issues. They actually care about seeing thoughtful, reasonable solutions presented that will not only help their families, but Albertans across the province. And that very much motivates me. I think we learn best, and we can put forward the best possible ideas and proposals if we talk to a wide spectrum of people. I also have a long, you know, I've worked in private practice. I worked on Bay Street when I was in Toronto, finishing my law degree, and I understand how to communicate in rooms that are full of, you know, business, oil and gas sector. That's really important. I think it's opening those relationships with people. So it was a, you know, it's not so much that I want to distance myself. I mean, I didn't get the opportunity to serve in government. That's absolutely true. But I got to listen and learn, and I think it does open up the possibility for me to sometimes take different positions, or to reflect back on some of the things that happened when you're in government and say, you know what, I heard. And I think we can take a different perspective now. And I've done that in terms of, for example, coming out at the beginning of when I launched and said, I don't know that we need to commit ourselves to being the champions of the consumer carbon tax, for example, right? Because we can take, I think the Alberta NDP bringing that in as part of the climate leadership plan was absolutely the right thing to do at the time. We know that it's a very effective tool in terms of addressing climate change, and it's actually a conservative tool that's been used, right, to actually create incentives to reduce carbon emissions. But Albertans haven't come along on it, and the federal government has undermined it significantly by creating exemptions, and the entire conversation around climate action has been sucked up into this conversation of carbon tax or no carbon tax, and it's given a free pass to the provincial UCP and the federal conservatives to avoid any conversation about climate change and any real action because they just focus on that. So I was able to take a position, and I take the position quite openly that I think we need to talk about a serious climate action plan that doesn't include a consumer carbon tax. We have to have that conversation now. We can't wait until, I don't know what, if Poilievre wins a federal election and he keeps true to his word. I don't want to wait 2 years. There's too much serious work to be done around climate action. And so I don't have to be tied to the fact that, yes, the Alberta NDP brought in the consumer carbon tax in this province. I have a little bit of distance from that to be able to reflect and say, you know what, maybe we can try a different tact. We can learn from what we've seen over the last 8 or 9 years and say, let's try something else.
I'm curious though. I want to explore that a little bit because of how you ended that. I mean, you took away one of the questions that I was going to ask you in a bit, so we're going to spend a little time on it now. But when we talk, when we hear people talking about how the NDP brought in the carbon tax, I always kind of like cringe just a little bit because it's worth noting that in effect, Alberta has had two
Oh, true.
carbon taxes and. The NDP one isn't the one that we have now. So I'll ask the question this way. Do you think that if the NDP carbon tax had remained, that program, which is significantly different than the federal program, I think worth highlighting, do you think that the tone and tenor of the conversation in regards to the carbon tax would be different, or do you think it was just doomed from the start?
Well, I think the it was a political stunt to
Oh,
eliminate
yeah.
the provincial carbon tax and to send it back to the feds because then it became something that the UCP could then point their fingers ongoing at the federal government constantly over and over again. When really, as you mentioned, it was a very different consumer carbon tax. And what it would have meant is that, any of the the revenue generated from that would have stayed within Alberta and could have driven further action on climate change right here in Alberta, where we have to be clear, Albertans are very much in support of taking climate action. Like this is not a, it's not an extreme view at all. In fact, the vast majority of Albertans want to see action on climate change. So certainly, it's hard to sort of determine what would have happened, had the UCP kept it here. But we know that that is part of the politicization of climate action that they have taken, right? By punting it back, then it became Trudeau's issue, and they could, yell at Trudeau and take the side of Poilievre on that. And it became a convenient excuse to not have to take action. Because let's be clear, the other part of that is the industrial carbon tax, which not only has existed for some time, but has been incredibly effective. And the UCP has maintained and even strengthened, right? They've increased the consumer, the industrial carbon tax. So we know that's actually an incredibly effective tool. And I've said this before, Nate, and I'll say it again. I genuinely believe there's certain UCP MLAs who aren't even aware that there is an industrial carbon tax that their government continued on because they're so caught up in that politicization of this issue of, axe the tax and whatever the case may be. But we've had a very effective industrial carbon tax in this province for some time, and that's something that I don't think even the UCP has hinted at removing, and I don't even know if Poilievre has talked about that. But that's certainly part of what a continuing climate action plan could look like, as well as, there's various other measures that could be taken, incentives, focusing on energy efficiency, talking about decarbonizing the grid, support for renewable energy. I mean, all of these, there's lots of mechanisms. And I didn't take that position lightly, right? That we should talk about a climate change without a consumer carbon tax. I did that in conversation with a lot of experts in the climate space. And in about 2 days, I'm going to release my climate policy, which, I want to show Albertans that there is a strong commitment, ongoing commitment to taking action on climate change. We do have to be, fulsome and having those conversations about what that looks like without a consumer carbon tax, but it is possible. And there is a fiscal, an economic, and a moral imperative to take action as quickly as possible on climate change, and we can't let it be politicized the way it has been any longer.
Okay. I'm just gonna go with the flow here because you're
Okay.
very, very fast. So
Oh yeah. It's one of my strengths and weaknesses. I always say as a lawyer, people really got their bang for their buck with me because in a 0.1 of a billable hour, I can get in a lot of advice.
I can definitely see that. But let's, you've got an environmental policy coming up in 2 days, which will be the day that we release. Well, 2 days, we'll be releasing this 2 days later. We're recording this for the audience on March 4th. It gets very complicated. I'm curious though, what would and I say this fully aware that the NDP has the policy conventions and it's the party that sets the policy. But I don't think that there's any debate that the leader can set the tone for what those things look like and start a conversation within the party in regards to what direction things would go. So, under Parekh Pancholi, NDP, what would your response be to the, I'm going to call it a continued renewables moratorium, because we've seen the we had the 7 months of we don't know why we're doing this, but we're doing this because Danny says so, and then we got the final version-ish released a couple of days ago, where it was okay, so all of the places in Alberta where wind farms would work, we're just going to take those right out of the deal. And there's been a lot of people who have expressed concern that this is going to have a massive impact on people's willingness to invest in Alberta in a renewables market. Now, Danny has said that, oh, no, the map that shows all of the things, that's not an accurate map. We're working on a map. We'll get it to you, which kind of makes me go, wait, you don't have a map? You rolled this out and you don't have a map yet? But what would, to get to the question, what would Arakki Pancholi, NDP, what would be the response specifically to the renewables, continued renewables moratorium?
Yeah. So I just had a conversation. I was in Calgary earlier today, as we talked about. I'm now home, but I was in Calgary earlier today, and I was just having a conversation with somebody about broadly about investment in Alberta and how we sustain economic growth. Because let's be clear, a strong economy and strong economic growth is how we continue to drive the investments in the areas like education and healthcare and all the things that we value as a quality of life and actually deserve as Albertans. We need to have that strong economic growth driving that. And the important piece that, when I think about the renewables, the important piece about this is that investment is incredibly it responsive to signals, right? And it follows very carefully the signals that come from government. Government shouldn't be directing and picking and choosing what industries are going to grow and fail, although we do see that that's exactly what's happening. But even the, I will say, incompetence with which these new rules are being rolled out and the lack of information, the signals that are being sent to investors is very much that this is an uncertain, unstable environment in which to invest. And when it comes to renewables, we were leading in the country by far in terms of investment and attracting investment in renewables. So not only is that has that been fundamentally undermined, but we're not giving the confidence at all to investors that they should in the future look, and they're just going to move elsewhere. And as somebody said to me today, investment moves away quickly. It takes a lot longer to come back. And we've now had almost a year of incredible uncertainty about renewables and specifically. And then to move on from the economic uncertainty that it continues to fester, I would say, in this province, we know we cannot reach a goal of net zero by 2050 unless we get focused on getting to a decarbonized electricity grid by 2035. And nobody's saying that, and we hear this all the time in the conversation, the dialogue that the government is having. They characterize it as oil and gas or renewables. And the reality is, it's oil and gas and renewables. None of these things are silver bullets. None of these things are the complete answer. My frustration sometimes is that there are very complex things happening in this province. And how we approach climate change, how we approach energy transition, these are complex issues. And we need to be able to have nuanced, complex conversations about them. More than anything else, too, climate change and climate action, as much as it is an imperative that we have to address, it's also an opportunity for this province. And that's one of the things that's driving me in this leadership campaign is I want to talk about the opportunities. The government has continued to demonstrate how small they think Alberta is, how much like their conversations are all about what they won't do, what they can't do, who they're fighting with, And it's a really small way of thinking about Alberta. That's not the Alberta that I know. It's not the Alberta that continues to attract thousands of people every month from across the country and across the world. We are a place of opportunity. Taking action on climate change, we have incredible expertise, incredible skills. We can attract so much investment, attract people, attract tech. Like, these are all exciting things that we should be leading on. Instead, we are showing that we are sticking our heads in the sand. We are uncertain. We are insecure as a place for investment. We don't seem to understand how to meet net zero goals. We are just we're closing our doors and making ourselves seem even smaller than before. And that's what I think is I want to talk about something different. I want to talk about a different story, and I want to talk about those bigger ideas, the bolder ideas, and how we actually take advantage of our opportunities that we're facing right now.
Would you keep the exclusion zones?
No, I'm none of this. I mean, the end of that, I mean, the short answer is none of this makes sense, right? Like, it doesn't seem to have been thoughtfully laid out. And I'm all for, of course, we should always be talking about doing things responsibly, and that's fine. But we're also there's no doubt that this is a different approach specific to renewables than to any other resource development in our province. And there's a reason why. It's being driven by ideology, not evidence, not facts. It's that's what's driving it. This pet peeve that whoever Danielle Smith is listening to this week is complaining about something, and all of a sudden she's bringing in, these policies that are really going to have long-term effects. So, look, I mean, I find it surprising that the party of, property rights and free market would be so interventionist. But that's because this isn't about logical consistency at all, right? This is about ideology and who's got the ear of the premier on any given day. So that's not how we make decisions. It's damaging for our ability to drive investment and to attract investment, but it's also incredibly damaging to our ability to address the challenges of climate change.
All right, I'm gonna make it to my first bullet point right here. So one of the things that is undeniably, and I've asked every candidate this question as an opener, but one of the things that is undeniable is that the NDP up until this point in time has been the party of Rachel Notley. I mean, there's a family dynasty that exists within the NDP when it comes to the Notley name. With Rachel Notley stepping down and somebody else taking the reins, there's a lot of speculation that's going on in regards to where does the NDP go from here. There's some people who are saying, well, the NDP will run for the hard left. I don't think that candidate has entered the race yet, although I hear it's coming soon. There's some people who are saying the NDP will stay exactly where the NDP are, and there's some people who are saying that the NDP will try to move a little bit more towards the center because that's where the votes are. So if you could, from a high ideals kind of standpoint, where would Iraki Pencholi NDP, where do you want to see the party go?
I want to see the party going where I think it's already well on its way. I think Rachel has obviously changed Alberta politics. She's changed Alberta progressive politics in profound ways and made the Alberta NDP a party that, millions of a million Albertans have now support, right? Like, we have seen an unprecedented level of support, not just in Edmonton and Calgary, but across this province for the Alberta NDP. And Rachel did that work to change the brand and the visuals of this party. But she didn't do that alone. She did it, if you look at our growth between 2019 and the most recent election, and who is part of our caucus now, who sits as an Alberta NDP MLA. You look at the supporters, the volunteers who came out. These are people who likely never prior to 2015, maybe even prior to 2019, thought of themselves as Alberta NDP supporters. But they're with us now. My view is that we need to grow the party and continue to show Albertans that the values that we hold dear as the Alberta NDP are actually the values of mainstream Albertans. It's not actually about, in my view, going left or going center. We just need to demonstrate to more Albertans that the things they care about, because we know what the things are that Albertans care about, we care about them too. They care about a resilient economy and jobs that are going to survive into the future. They care about a strong public education and strong public healthcare system. They care about action on climate change. Those are all things that are profoundly part of who we are as the Alberta NDP. And so, We don't have to move any direction. We just need to grow. And there's naturally communities of people in this province who are progressive that we just need to do a better job of engaging with. I think about young people, I think about Indigenous communities, and think about lots of the folks out in rural communities who are naturally share those values. We just need to be more present and show up and engage with them and show them that the things they care about are reflected in the Alberta NDP. For me, growing the party is perhaps the most profound reason that I'm involved in this leadership race. I want to see us grow. I want to see more people feeling like they are contributing to and engaged with and part of what we're doing. Because I truly believe that's the way we win in 2027. We take the foundation that Rachel has laid and the incredible work of our existing MLAs. Many new folks in both Calgary and Edmonton who have joined the team, who bring a diverse amount of experiences. They probably weren't overly partisan either before they got involved. And they were probably a lot like me in 2019, right? They're just like, wow, this is something I want to be a part of. And there are a lot of Albertans who are like that. And I could feel that palpably when I was on the doors. I knocked doors, Nate, in probably almost every constituency in Calgary. I've knocked on doors in Red Deer and Strathcona County and Morinville and Lethbridge. I've knocked doors all across this province leading up to the provincial election in 23. And I can tell you that for the first time, it really felt like there were people who were giving a pause and thinking about who they would vote for in a way that they didn't pause about before. Now, I will say where I think we perhaps fell a little bit short in the 23 election. We did a pretty good job of describing, who to vote against. We could have done a little bit more to show Albertans what they could vote for. And that's the work that I'm interested in doing. And I think if we talk about that, this idea of Alberta as being this place of opportunity, of optimism, that brings more people in. And I don't think it's about left or center or where it is. I just think it's getting more people excited and engaged in the activity and the excitement of improving our province, building upon those opportunities, making it the way we always believed it was for many of us when we chose this province as home. So that's what I think is the opportunity, is just growing and making more people feel like they're part of what we're doing.
How wild is it with the signs? Because here's the thing, as you were talking about the campaign, we've seen the signs that you guys rolled out, the what will she do next with the weather vane and the stormy clouds, and it was all very, very scary. I personally was not a fan of them because it like highlighted her really, really well, and it almost gave her like a halo. And I was like, I'm not sure if that's the message, but at least the message the NDP wanted to send. But there was a lot of conversation around the signs, and then the signs got responded to by the UCP, where they put up the signs in front of the sign that said lower taxes, and now we have budget 2024, and that seems to be the biggest just kidding moment. Like, at what point does that sign, whole sign thing, just become like the meme for Alberta politics?
Well, it's unfortunate that I wasn't crazy about that campaign myself. I leave that camp those campaign decisions to other people in that case. What I will say is we were right about the fact that you can't trust Danielle Smith, but that I think only gets you so far, because it's true. She certainly has not delivered on her promises. We've seen the last year that the priorities that she's focused on are none of the things that are the priorities of Albertans. And she never campaigned on a moratorium on renewables, on bringing in a policy to target trans kids. She didn't talk about pulling out of the CPP. She did talk about cutting taxes, and she hasn't done that. So, I mean, we were, I guess, right in that sense of you can't trust Danielle Smith, but my view is that being negative and the sort of the campaign of the not it wasn't just our campaign. I would say the tone of politics right now is incredibly driven by fear and anger and negativity. And my sense of that is that that's an emotion. It's a low-level emotion that's easy to push. It can get you to win some votes in the moment, right? It can get people to like a tweet or share a tweet. And I still call them tweets. That's what they are. I still call it Twitter too. Anyways, you can trigger that emotion enough to get people to do that. But it also leads to despair, and it leads to people feeling isolated and that overwhelmed by how awful things are. I truly think that if you want to get more people engaged, and whether it be in politics or anything, you actually have to trigger, I think, a more important emotion, which is hope. which is optimism. That's how you actually get people to want to work together and find solutions. And I'm very much seeing that, like, that's the tone we've taken in our in my leadership campaign so far, deliberately, intentionally. And the response from people has been profoundly that it's they're grateful for that. They want to be involved in that. They get excited by that. That's how you get people to want to do things to make things a better province, a better city, better community. The anger and fear only go so far. And I have to be honest, Nate, like, I'm not interested in doing this just to get votes. You can win elections in the day, but if you don't have people behind you and engaged in the complex work of the complex challenges we have, you won't have them behind you when you're trying to govern. I'm not really crazy about the idea of just saying people, just give us your vote for today because you're angry or upset, because the next day you got to do the work, and people have to feel engaged in that work, and they're only going to do it if they feel like there's something positive that they can work towards. That's how you get, I think, real change, and that's what I'm interested in doing.
All right, good answer. Now that being said, the question, the next series of questions that I want to ask you know, I agree that there's tremendous value in not going negative. But there are also some harsh realities that's quite simply are negative. The one of the big conversations that's been going on in the province has to do with the housing and the houselessness crisis. I have a couple of other bullet points under the broad, which you may address in your answers because you seem to be very thorough that way. But what are your thoughts on the housing? What are your thoughts on the houselessness crisis? We've seen Edmonton, and I'm just gonna call it like it is. I mean, the Alberta government under the UCP is actively trying to manufacture fear. And we saw this on our end when we were receiving DMs from a high-ranking UCP staffer who was like, "Hey, here's the real story with the encampments." And we've since seen that directly rebutted by the people who were directly involved in those situations. So there's definitely they're lying for a reason. And that's not doing anything to solve the problem of the encampments. It's not doing anything to solve the houselessness crisis. So what are the solutions that Team Pancholi bring to the table for that?
Yeah. So part of it is that we cannot continue to allow very profound issues that are having a direct impact on the human dignity of people's lives in this province, treat them like they are political footballs. You know, it's been quite shocking, in my view, to hear, you know, the rhetoric coming out of the government, and talking about, for those of us, like my colleague Janice Irwin and Brooks Arcand-Paul, who stood there and witnessed what was happening with the encampment suites, to say that, you know, supporting those people, those vulnerable people, was actually saying that we want people to live in encampments. No, ev we want every person to live in dignity. And sweeping an encampment away when people are just, you know, without any plan for where they're going to go, without addressing the root causes of the challenges, without providing the supports they need to provide, that is inhumane, I'll be quite honest, right? And nobody wants people living in encampments. We want everybody to have a home and safety and all the supports they need. And it became such a, like, talking point that was just profoundly inhumane, because the problem is, when we talk about the encampments, they are symbolic of a failure on a number of fronts. Yes, it's a failure on the investment in affordable housing, but it is also a failure of addressing reconciliation. And I say that as somebody who was for 4 years the critic for Children's Services, and I know firsthand that, of course, the number of young people and children who are part of the child intervention system who end up on the streets because we, as soon as they turn 18, they get cut off. And even before they turn 18, that, like, no child wants to grow up in the child intervention system. I remember having conversations with some folks who work on the front lines in Edmonton, downtown Edmonton, with these communities of people. And they say to me, you know, 95% of the people that we are working with day in and day out came from the child intervention system. If we're not talking about that, if we're not talking about the fact that we've seen record numbers of young people dying from the opioid crisis and they end up in homelessness and they end up in encampments, it is far too easy to use this as a political football and say this is just about, you either like the lawlessness or the crime that goes along with encampments, or you don't. Nobody wants this for people. What we want is people to be treated with dignity. And all we've seen is sort of solutions that focus on temporary band-aid fixes. We talk about, the affordability crisis and people struggling to find food. And we talk about the homelessness crisis. And what we hear in response is, here's some funding for food banks and here's some funding for shelters. Shelters which don't have the standards where people even feel safe going to. There's a reason why people are not going to shelters. And if we're not talking about that, then we're treating them with disrespect. And so this is an example of incredibly complex problems that you can win a moment and maybe have a gotcha meme on a Twitter account, take a quote out of context, make it all about crime and safety, which, by the way, crime and safety is and crime is something that we have to address. It's not this or that. It's all of those pieces, right? People who work downtown, have businesses downtown, they have a right to feel safe and secure as well, as do the people living in encampments, as do the people going to shelters, as to the people who are looking for affordable housing. We all do. So we can't just have simple answers. So, to me, I'm exhausted by the cuts to social services that have occurred significantly over the last 5 years, which have created the circumstances which more and more people are in vulnerable, situations. And to write off any solution as ideological, is I think really profoundly irresponsible.
Oh, you teed me up for my next one.
Yeah. I
Albert.
feel like this is like going back and forth here, Nate. I didn't mean to
No,
do
it
that, but
is. It's really well. I'll say this. I wrote down one of the things that you said in there because boy, did you crush a line. Not living in encampments, living in dignity. Oh, put that on a mug. We talk about things not being ideological and things should be evidence-based. That brings us to the opioid crisis because we have seen the Alberta model has been doing one of the best jobs in Canada for killing people. I don't know if that's the goal, but that's the reality, and the statistics absolutely bear that out. So, what are your thoughts on the opioid crisis?
The response is very similar, which is that for any of those people who are, and I know you see it on the front lines, Nate, and I know that I've heard it from people on the front lines, no tool should be off the table right now, as far as I'm concerned. Again, we've allowed this really polarized conversation of it's harm reduction or recovery. And I have to say, I have to check the instinct as well too. Sometimes when we hear this government only talk about recovery, my instinct is then to also talk about harm reduction, and then people think it's one or the other. So I think we all have a role to play in making sure that we are talking about the full spectrum of things, because it allows for that dichotomy to appear in people's minds. And look, I'll say, I mean, the thing about harm reduction, and I am by no means an expert, but I think, we do have to understand that harm reduction, the idea of it goes counter to what many of us growing up thought we were told about, drug use, right? You should never condone it. You should never allow it. You should never encourage it. And that's what I think is the hurdle that, you're coming over. But we know 100% that harm reduction works because it keeps people alive. So it's not harm reduction or recovery. It's all of those things. Of course, the goal is always to make sure that we can try to provide support to somebody to get to recovery, and that recovery is long lasting. Nobody will dispute that. Nobody wants anybody to be on drugs, and incredibly dangerous drugs, their entire life. We want to support people to get to recovery, but that may not be realistically where somebody ends up. But they're still a human being that deserve to be alive. And let's be clear, I think the opioid crisis in particular shows that it crosses a lot of lines. It's not just like people who are suffering from opioid addictions, and it might not even be an addiction. Sometimes it's somebody who just takes something at a party or something like that. Like th this is crossing socioeconomic lines. It's all of us have might know somebody or do know somebody whose family member or friend or colleague has been affected by this. So this is not something we isolate to just certain communities, right? And we all have to be responsible for this, and we all have to understand the complexity of the issues that do require every tool on the table. When we're talking about the crisis that we are seeing, I think we're up to, I think, 5 Albertans a day, right, who may be losing their lives as a result of this. Nothing should be off the table, and everything should be driven by research, by evidence. And the goal should be keeping people alive, and yes, to get to recovery. But we cannot exclude any potential option. And this is something that needs to be removed from the politicization of the ideology. And like I said, I think we all have to participate in that, in talking about all of the tools at our disposal and trying to find ways to support people the best we know and the best the evidence suggests.
I gotta say, I appreciate the fact that you've acknowledged that it's not a binary thing. I mean, I know people who are in various different stages of recovery. Some of them abstinence absolutely works for, some of them it doesn't. And I mean, there's when we take a look at what kicked off the opioid crisis in a big way, we're talking about largely there were prescription medications that were being given for prescription reasons. And those medications had been misrepresented to the people who were prescribing them, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean that opioids don't have a place in the healthcare continuum. And there are certainly people who are going to be reliant on opioids for the rest of their lives. But if it's in a for like underlying medical reasons, but if it's in a continuum of clinical care with a regulated supply, then people die a lot less. So that's, the next question. And I've asked every single candidate that we've had on the show thus far, safe supply. I mean, one of the things that we hear from all of the groups that are working on the street, one of the things that we hear from people who are working in the medical community and the first responder community is the biggest thing that's driving deaths right now on the street is the fact that people think that they're getting drug X, but they're also getting drug X and diabetes medications mixed into it, or drug X and drain cleaner mixed into it, or not drug X at all. It's something entirely different than what they thought they were buying. So, given all of that, what's your personal stance on safe supply?
I can't really say that I have a personal stance on safe supply so much as because I don't think it should matter what my personal stance is on it. I think it should be based on evidence, right? So I know there's good evidence that safe supply does work. There's some contradictory evidence. Like I would say it shouldn't be my personal opinion. It should be about what does the evidence suggest. I want Albertans to stay alive. There's no doubt about that. And we should be unequivocal about that. And it's funny that that needs to be said, but it does need to be said. I want people to stay alive. And I want them to stay alive, and I think we should explore all those options that may be necessary to keep them alive and to keep them potentially, because again, not everybody's going to get to recovery, and we also know recovery is not a permanent state of being. We know many people go through recovery and they slide back, and they go, it's not just an endpoint that you reach and then you're done, right? Like it is an ongoing thing. So I go back to if evidence suggests we should be considering this or trying this, then we should not rule it out because of ideology, not rule it out because we don't want to, we don't like the way it sounds. So, I just genuinely believe I am not the expert in this, right? And there's lots of people who are doing incredibly important research in many jurisdictions, and we have to consider all the factors that are different. What makes, Edmonton situation perhaps, or a Calgary situation perhaps, Lethbridge's situation unique? Is it unique? I don't know, but we need to be able to be looking at all those things, and it should be the people who have expertise and knowledge who are making those decisions, not ideological politicians.
Let me rephrase the question then. Would you support the response to the opioid crisis being driven by the medical community more so than the political class?
Medical more than political, yes, but it's not just medical, right? Because we have to be acknowledged that there's more factors at play. These are complex. It's not purely a medical issue either, right? Because we have to think about what are the support services that are available, what are the housing options that are available, what's the, so I like just like with COVID and anything else, we have to factor all of those pieces in. But yes, it should not be driven by politicians, and it should not be driven by ideology. It should be driven the experts in all of the factors, because people who are either, suffering from addiction or who are living with addiction, they, or even those people who may be trying it for the first time, they are human beings with all the complexities that they bring, right? Their histories, their traumas, their medical experience, where they're living, what they have access to. And so it's got to be more than just the medical community, because that has to be part of all the solutions that we're talking about, but certainly should not be driven by politicians.
I want to talk about the policy set that we saw Danielle Smith. I can't say unveil, I would say more unleash, because I think it's more apropos for what she did with her 8 minute timeshare on the Lake of Fire video. It is a much more complex issue than it's been represented in a lot of ways. I mean, first of all, 99% of what she presented is just demonstrably false. I can prove it with an etch-a-sketch. So there's that piece. But the way that we've talked about it on the show historically has been she threw a great big target up on the wall, and at the very, very center of that target, the very bullseye of that target, is unquestionably trans kids and trans kids' rights to gender-affirming care. But there's a whole lot of circles around that bullseye that radiate outward that include things like adult choice in sports and quite literally parents' choice in ensuring that their kids get access to health care. So it gets to be really, really complex really, really quickly. What is your response to that broad policy set is the first part of the question that I want to ask.
So we saw even prior to that announcement video, which, I don't know, the timing was oddly coincidental with her visit and sit down with Tucker Carlson and her upcoming leadership review. I don't think that's a coincidence at all. But leading up to it, of course, this conversation has been not just bubbling under the surface, because it has risen above the surface, about the profound amount of misinformation that has been deliberately and intentionally spread in many communities and amongst parents. And I want to begin by saying I am a parent. I'm a parent of young kids. I'm a parent of kids in school. And I understand the instinct of parents to want to know what's happening with their kids at school, to understand what they're being taught. That's a natural instinct for parents to have. What's not natural is the profound amount of misinformation that has been de deliberately spread. So I was the education critic up until I chose to, seek the leadership for the Alberta NDP. And during that time, I had many conversations with school boards, and I'd say things like, look, there is this incredible amount of misinformation. There's parents who are hearing things about what's in the curriculum and what's being taught and what books are being used, which are just not true. They are stories that are pulled out of the States, or like there's a meme that's going around. And I think we all have an obligation, and I'd say this to school boards, what are you doing to help parents understand better what's happening and being taught in schools? Because there is that misinformation out there. And what Danielle Smith chose to do was to capitalize on that misinformation and spread an incredible amount of, it's completely not based in fact, this policy that she's put out, rather than bringing parents and teachers together to say, okay, how can we better communicate what is actually happening in schools? What is actually being taught? What resources are being used? How you can talk to your teacher, how you can, your child's teacher, how you can better understand. There was an opportunity there to bring people together to talk, and instead she chose to further divide them, and of course to continue to pit parents against teachers. So we'll begin with, of course, the absolute logical inconsistency of a government that claims that they're libertarian to and they're protecting parental rights, to now actually tell a parent that you who are working with medical professionals with their child to say, no matter what care you think, or your med this medical professional and you all decide is best for your child, you don't get to make that decision. I, Danielle Smith, and I'm going to come in and tell you what you can and cannot do. That's so profoundly hypocritical. I can't even, can't even wrap my head around it. But then, to me, it is also, of course, the risk of what's happening here, for kids understanding about sexual education. My husband is a teacher. He will tell me right off the bat, he's like, it is impossible to get parents to fill out, field trip forms and all that. And what we're going to have generations of kids not having access to sex education, which isn't just about sex education. It's all about how to protect themselves as well from being victimized. It's about consent education, which is deeply and profoundly important. So there's all of that piece. But at the heart of it is the politicization and using as a target the most vulnerable kids you can think of. I mentioned already that I was a critic for Children's Services. We know how overrepresented children, trans kids, Kids in the 2S LGBTQ community are in child intervention. They don't feel safe, and we're taking away one of their safe spaces. And any teacher will tell you that they go in there, they will always want to work with parents. If there is a situation with a student, they're always going to try to work with parents. And it's only where they feel that there is a risk to that student that they would not. And they're professionals, they have standards, there's way to manage that. And to use these kids, the message it sends to these incredibly vulnerable kids is again an incredible abdication of responsibility of government. So this has obviously been done to appease, I don't know, David Parker, Take Back Alberta, Tucker Carlson. I don't know. But I will also say that this has come up in many conversations with people who are not even, again, typically perhaps consider themselves NDP supporters. I've had lots of conversations with these folks in the last while, and this keeps coming up by people who think this is just completely cruel and unnecessary. Most people want to make sure vulnerable kids are safe, and that's where we come from. And if there's misunderstanding out there, there's ways to bridge that communication, to expand, better understand each other, which again should be our objective, is making sure that people better understand each other rather than capitalize on this divisiveness to kind of get votes for the moment or win a leadership review or whatever the case may be. There's responsibility that comes with government, there's a responsibility that comes with leadership. And we've seen a complete abdication of that.
One of the things that I found striking about Danielle Smith's tenure is she has, in a way that we've seen some politicians do south of the border, managed to find a way to politicize facts. And this is fascinating to me because historically, what was political, what a political ideology was a response to a problem. And there would be different viewpoints and different perspectives based on a bunch of different things in regards to how do we solve problem X. But what Danielle Smith and the UCP seem to have been able to do under the circumstances is to say, you know what, as much as we've historically defined the problem by things like facts and reality, we're going to politicize the actual interpretation of facts and reality. And there's not really like there's only so much interpretation of facts that you can do because it's a fact. It's kind of immutable. But that's one of the things that they've been able to do. And there's a lot of people who have commented that that has really poisoned the discourse because now we're not just talking about, you know, we had a conversation on the show here with a physician who's actually providing gender affirming care. And we asked her straight up, in order to address the myth, how many children's genitals have you mutilated? And her response was immediately to say, well, we wouldn't call it mutilation in medicine, which is totally valid. And second of all, none. So that's a really important piece of context. But there are people who believe because the facts have been so politicized that this is a thing that's happening, and therefore we must be outraged about it. How does the NDP under you diffuse, like, how do you undamage that? I had to check my language for a second.
And
There's another term that I would use normally, but I can't think of the
yeah,
name of it.
I can guess. I don't know that we single-handedly can, of course, right? But I think one of the things that I just talked about is one of the tactics that I think we need to focus on. It can't actually always be the partisan characters like myself, like, people who are in the partisan world to be leaders on this. And it's one of the reasons why I said I talk to school boards and I say, you play a role here. You're nonpartisan. You understand the school system. How can you best communicate? How can you counter misinformation by actually providing the facts and the information to parents? Well, how can you work with them collaboratively to better understand, to build those communication channels? So one of the answers I'd say is that it can't be up to the politicians, because we see that it's being used like for nefarious purposes to get votes, to do all that kind of stuff. This is not based in fact what's happened by, this trans policy. There's no fact here. It's meant to trigger emotion and to get the votes in the moment and to get the support in the moment. So one of the things, of course, my responsibility as a political leader is to not engage in that and to not do that, but also to encourage people other people to they don't have to say what I'm saying. I'm a political figure. I have a different perspective. They should say what they know, and they need to be empowered to speak up. And again, I go back to, if you want people to be empowered and to feel engaged to do the work, you can't trigger fear and hate and anger. You actually have to say, look, like, let's talk about how we can better have a relationship with parents. Like, let's open those lines of communication. That's a hopeful thing. That's an optimistic thing. How can I welcome you, parent, into my classroom to better understand what I'm doing here? How can I answer your question? And for parents to say, this is what I heard and this is what I'm worried about. How can I get some more information? And of course, we've got some cultural barriers and language barriers, and we just have to start to think that we know that we all are, can we agree that we all want to protect kids? We all want kids to be safe and feel warm and inclusive environments. And that if we can agree on that, okay, so when, let's begin with that place of opportunity that we can work together to make kids feel more secure and safe in school and wherever they are. And then what goes outward from there? I think that's what I'm trying to convey from my political perspective, or at least the position I'm in. But it can't just be me. And of course, I think we have to be able to work with each other as Albertans to kind of be like, what is the province we want? And how do we all play a role? And getting out of that despair is part of the way we do that. Because overwhelmingly, I think Albertans do care about protecting vulnerable kids. They don't want kids to feel unsafe. And so let's show that warmth and let's show that love and let's show that eagerness to understand and to better communicate with each other. And maybe that's Pollyanna, maybe it's idealistic, but I think that's the only way we get out of this really divisive, dark place that I think some politicians are capitalizing on.
One of the big things that a lot of people have said is that Danielle Smith, and I don't think that there's any debate on this, she is a profoundly effective speaker, as long as she has a script in front of her. But if she's got a script in front of her, then she is able to deliver that script with such skill that the vast majority of people see sincerity and they see what they perceive to be authenticity. There's just like, you can try to trash talk someone as much as you want, but she's very, 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 very good at that. And I mean, this was clear in the, and no disrespect to Rachel Notley, to be clear, but the difference in styles was highlighted particularly during the debates in the run-up to the election. I don't think there's any debate that, no pun intended, but I don't think there's any debate that Danielle Smith won that debate. And I don't want to be the person to say she crushed it, but she crushed it. So, how do you, as leader of the NDP, you would be responsible for going head to head with Danielle Smith. How do you do that? And by way of that question, I want to finish up the section on the trans piece. What would you say to Danielle Smith about these policies face to face? What would be your message to her?
So I'll begin by saying I agree. Danielle Smith is a very effective communicator, right? There's no doubt about that. She's worked in showbiz and radio and TV for quite some time. She's very, very good, and she's very warm, and she comes across as very warm. Ultimately, I think in the my job, and this is something I've learned in my 4.5 years, 5 years of being in politics, I actually don't focus that much on talking to the premier. It was Jason Kenney for some time, and now it's Danielle Smith. My focus is talking to Albertans. And so that's the audience. No matter whether I'm in the legislature or I'm here or even on a debate stage, I'm not trying to convince Danielle Smith. I want to talk to Albertans, and I want to convey to them what I've heard, amplify their voices, and give them hope to talk about and engage in the hard work of solving complex issues with complex solutions. And that's what I would focus on. So to me, I don't know that I would focus on talking to Danielle Smith. I would talk to the trans child and say, I know this might be a scary time. I understand why. There are many, many adults in your life who care deeply about making sure that you're safe, and hopefully they're your parents. But if they're not, there's a whole community and a whole village of people around you who do want to make sure that you're safe and that you can be who you are. And my job is to let you know, as a leader in this province, that I see you and I care about you and I want to make sure you're safe, and I'm going to do what I can to make sure that happens. And I want to say to parents, I understand your need to want to know what happens in your child's classroom and to engage and to be protect them. That's what you want to do as a parent. It's an instinct that I understand deeply. And we want to make sure you do that too. And we want to make sure you do that with facts and information and the best tools at your disposal to communicate and understand what's happening in your child's school. That's what we want to do. So for me, that's what my focus would be, is less on talking to Danielle Smith, less on trying to convince the UCP on the other side of the chamber, and making sure that Albertans hear that there is a province full of opportunity, full of hope in this, that we all are all part of, and we can work together to make it better.
I mean, that's a very good answer. But I find myself wondering, and we talked a little bit about this in the pre-interview, but I find myself wondering if the role of opposition, and there's some places where, and again, the Tylenol is a very good example of how effective opposition can bring important things to the forefront. But I'm curious if, when we're talking about the role of opposition, if is there any room? Here's the question that I want to ask. Is there any room in the legislature or in the political discourse between government and opposition for actual debate and exchange of ideas, or is that just gone? Because there's a part of me that wants to think that there is some way, I don't know what it is, perhaps cartoons, to communicate with the powers that be that are making these decisions. You're about to do a big thing really, really badly. Can we please talk about this before you do it? Is there room for that, or is that just, am I being Pollyanna?
I think there are small pockets of opportunity to have those kinds of conversations. I think it depends. Government and ministers hold a lot of the information and the power, and what they're willing to work with the opposition on. It's really in their control to do that. Certainly, I can tell you that myself, and I know many of my colleagues have good working relationships with a number of UCP MLAs, and we don't with others. And it really will depend. I have to say I've been disheartened by the level of collaboration and opportunity to have those discussions in the chamber, in the legislature. But I will say that I became an MLA a year before COVID hit. And so I got to, unfortunately, the act of COVID, which was very isolating for many people, it also polarized our political discussions, largely because I never got to even interact with UCP MLAs outside of the chamber. There was no events, obviously, we're social distance, there's no opportunity, we're all under enormous stress. And so kind of dehumanized us to each other, I think. And I have noted that since, COVID has, at least those restrictions have gone. There's been more opportunity for a reminder that we may disagree with each other about the way we get to certain places, but genuinely many, many folks on obviously on both sides are in this because they have an idea about wanting to improve things, or they care about certain issues, they care about their constituents. I would hope, I think that tone is set very much by government, because they have the majority, and of course they have a lot of the information and the power in that space. But certainly that's a tone, that's also how we can handle ourselves as opposition. And I will say that I have felt many times as an opposition MLA that I have been able to achieve results. It hasn't been the direct, me doing it. I don't get to make those decisions. One of those accomplishments for me personally is, I think my contribution on the work to getting, affordable, accessible childcare become a bit more of a reality in this province. I care deeply about the policy, and I spoke to Albertans about that, and Albertans spoke and used their voice to talk to the government. The government wasn't listening to me, but there's ways to affect change as opposition. That is more indirect, but can influence things. I would love to be in the position to actually make those calls and be the government and be obviously the premier of this province, so we can make those decisions. And I do hope that as premier, I would like to try to change the opportunity for collaboration and cooperation and exchange of ideas with government, because ultimately I'm in this to get things done for Albertans. That's why I'm here. Not to beat them, not to win the moment, not to win the day, not to show them I'm, we're better than they are, or whatever the case may be, or can put out a quippier meme or something like that. I'm here for Albertans. That's what I did this do this job for. And it's hard work and it's worthwhile work because we do affect change. And so I'm interested in getting more things done, and that's why I want to be leader of the party, and the next premier of the province.
I got one last, and you stole my follow-up from me again there, because I was going to go, well, would you do it differently? And then you just went ahead and said that you would. So there's that. I got one last question for you, and it's the same question that I've asked all of the candidates that we've interviewed so far, as a kind of a closing question. And we saw a column today. I mean, today's March 4th. We saw a column today written by Don Braid, where he was saying, expect an announcement, Alberta. The NDP has a history of, and you've addressed this earlier, but the NDP does have a history of having sort of very closed ranks. And there has been speculation for the better part of 2 months now that there's a potential NDP leadership candidate who is not part of those ranks at all. And it is at the party's discretion whether or not this individual would be able to even enter the leadership race. So I'm curious, what are your thoughts? Would you support the candidacy of a Nahed Nenshi, or would you prefer that he maybe just keeps doing the radio stuff on CBC with Farkas? What are your thoughts?
He absolutely should run if he wants to run. Like, 100%. My whole approach, my cons you know, from the beginning has been that we need to grow our party. We need to stop, limiting ourselves or creating barriers to people joining the party. And I actually have to tell you, I don't think that there's a question as to whether or not the party will allow him to run. Our leadership rules. Very straightforward. Yes, there's a requirement about membership for 6 months, but there's also built in there a process for an exception to be made. I don't genuinely think that the party would try to keep anybody out, and I certainly don't think anybody should be kept out of the race. I think if Nahed wants to run, he should absolutely run. To me, that I am really genuinely interested in growing our party and the energy and excitement that comes from a lot of people being interested in running. It speaks to the fact that we are the party that everybody should be looking at as the potential next government of this province. So yeah, I'm not surprised Nahed Nenshi wants the job. It's going to be a good job. It's going to be an important job. So he should certainly enter the race, and we'll have a great exchange of ideas. This is going to be a great time for our party to really talk about all these exciting ideas, inviting all these people, all this attention. It's the first race we've had that's had this level of scrutiny. And it's going to show everybody that we are very much the party that is going to be the government in this province once again. So yeah, I welcome it.
Alrighty. I have one last question that I'm going to ask after I give you the floor, because I think it's really important. You've been very, very good about answering my questions and predicting my questions. But is there anything else before I ask that last question? Is there anything else that you want to you say? Anything else you want people to hear? Floor is yours.
Thanks, Nate. I think I just want everybody to know that this is a really important race. I think Albertans have a healthy history in this province of getting involved in leadership races because they, whether they support the party or not. We've known that that's happened in the UCP. It's happened with PC races in the past. And the reason why Albertans do that is because they're looking at the leadership candidates and saying that could be the next premier of this province. And I hope that people are looking at the Alberta NDP race the same way and knowing that one of us could be the next premier of this province. I got into this. I wanted to do this because I think there's stories of Albertans. I think of Calgary and how diverse it is. I think about Edmonton, how diverse it is. I think of all these mid-sized and small cities and rural communities that are very different than the stories we've been heard as Albert we've been told by as Albertans for so long about who we are. I want to tell those stories. I want us to be leading in opportunity and optimism in this country because we have all the foundation to do so. So I hope people get excited. I hope they get engaged. I hope they buy a membership. And I'll just put a plug in and say you can go to voteracky.ca, sign up for a membership there, make a donation, join our team. I feel really good about the work we're doing because this is an exciting time for the province. And so I hope Albertans feel excited and engaged about it too and get involved.
Last question. I mean, we've seen the social media posts about the relationship that you have with Janice Irwin. Have you ever cat-sitted oregano?
Do you know what? She kept oregano for me for a very long time. She hid him from me. I actually only just met oregano in person. I think there was like a weird jealousy thing happening very recently. Now, as you may know, Janice has a new cat named Basil. However, I like to think of it like a Fawlty Towers Basil is what I'm calling the cat. So I don't know how long she's going to keep Basil for me as well. But no, I haven't cat sitted oregano yet. But I plan to spend a lot of time with both cats. And Janice, by the way, I've said this to a few people, and I genuinely mean it. You don't need to enter into politics thinking you're going to make a friend. Politics is work. It's hard work. It's tough work. And I have been very privileged to form a good friendship with probably one of the best human beings I can think of, which is Janice Irwin. She is has as big of a heart as people think she does, and she's as generous with her heart as people think she is. So I am lucky to have her friendship, and maybe that's why oregano is jealous of me. I don't know.
Do you think in 20 years she's gonna have like the cat lady and the whole spice rack going on?
Oh, the whole spice rack. I love it. By the way, spice rack used to be one of my nicknames. That's why I'm
Oh.
like, by the way, we're putting out a whole bunch of like new buttons for the campaign where we're using like, puns on my name, like rack star and rack the vote and we will rack you. So when you said spice rack, I got a little excited because that used to be one of my nicknames. Yeah, she'll probably have them all. And I've already kind of started to name them. Although I used to tease her because she used to claim she was a dog person, but then she just keeps collecting cats. Meanwhile, she has spent a bit of time with my dog. So I guess she's sort of a dog auntie. So that's not so bad.
Awesome. Greg, I want to thank you so much for taking the time for chatting tonight. And I've said this, I'm going to make a point of saying it to you as well. There was a period in the Alberta politics realm where there were some folks with the New Democratic Party of Alberta that were very, very unhappy with the breakdown. And I really, really appreciate the fact that despite our acerbic commentary and satire and that you're still willing to sit down and take the time to chat with us tonight. Because as I've said to the other leadership candidates, I really, really do believe that what this province needs is more conversations, not less of them. And we do jokes, we do satire and commentary here. So you
I was
can't.
just waiting to be asked, Nate. I was just waiting to be
Oh,
asked.
we
I
were
was,
told that we weren't allowed to ask for a while.
well, I don't know. I always say ask for forgiveness, not permission. So whatever.
I agree 100%. Thank you so much for taking the time, and we'll be following the leadership race very closely.
Thanks, Nate. I appreciate it.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, we would love nothing more than if you thought about signing up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab, where for just the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, you can help us continue to produce this kind of content. Whether you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, in which case, maybe leave a review and a rating, or whether you're watching it on one of our streaming platforms, we want to say a big thank you to everybody who is part of the Breakdown's audience. And as always, take care of each other and keep the conversation going.